Hey everyone, this is Christian. Just as an intro to the podcast, Hagen, and I blame Hagen for this, he had no headphones on, so I recorded, or he recorded my voice as well, so it's a little bit delay in that there is an echo from the US that is introduced to my to his track as well. So apologies for that, we try hard next time. But I think still, it's a nice podcast. So enjoy, and hopefully we'll make the next one rather quick. Okay, here we go. Long time no podcast.
Hearing. This is Hagen.
Yeah, that's Christian. From Berlin and from all over the world.
All over the world. And the podcast is called Insert Buzzwords too. So
yeah, by the way in case you forgot.
And I think it's number a million.
No, 21.
Oh, shit.
But close. Totally almost. Almost a million.
Our ambitious plan.
Yeah, but because we are so busy. Busy.
True. And I'm now more on the side of human resourcing, and you are more on the side of, I would say, what would you say?
Being amazing.
You're not really an engineer anymore. That wouldn't be.
No, I'm the EMEA lead for proactive customer engagement.
And that's a fancy title, man.
That's a fancy title.
And I have no idea what that is. I guess you are trying with customers and make them happy.
No, we proactively, like the name suggests, we proactively think about what the customer might need, and then
it's like you have this granny at the corner and you just drag her over the street.
and then we tell her how much it costs the service, like. And then we drag her back because we know that she wants back. So we just drag her back and forth and let her pay every time. No, that's not. I mean, no, but it's not a podcast about our professions, only about our ambitions. No, yeah, I don't know.
Makes sense. My ambition is to write closure for real, and I'm not doing that anymore. Also, so that's not happening.
Yeah, I still have my little Golang spiel that I can do. So yeah, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm happy. It's just that this stuff is not happening so much anymore. But what was interesting should we like talk a little bit about assessing cross-functional teams? That was something I can talk about.
Yeah, go ahead. Our last podcast was 6 months ago, so whatever happened in 6 months, you can start talking about.
Always start talking Pulsar, which is not new, but new messaging system on Apache landscape.
Yeah, okay, let's do Pulsar then. What's Pulsar?
Pulsar is an open source distributed PubSub messaging system originally created at Yahoo and now part of the Apache Software Foundation. That's what their mission statement seems to be.
And they did Kafka before as well, right?
No, that was LinkedIn.
Ah, damn.
But I think it's funny that it's still... So there is Apache, like, with all these stream processors, it's like these British... car companies in the 80s where like it was literally just one company, but there were a million car manufacturers, and but they were all under the same umbrella. Mm-hmm. I don't know how healthy that is to have stream processing engines and then I don't know. So Kafka seems to be very similar in Pulsar. What I'm missing is like we're doing this because of AI. Right, what are you solving? Kafka already solves a whole bunch of problems, and what's now the reason why you need another one? But I guess
I do not understand yet, but like Kafka is this PubSub thing, right? But it's not a true queue, and that's what Pulsar tries to solve as well. Did I get this right?
Kafka is a queue of sort. It's depending on how you use it and how you implement your use case. Maybe Pulsar is making more assumptions, but I guess we will find out future. It's just interesting that there's now a new thing, and apparently they have also a REST API, so something that's, I guess, easier. You have easier access because it's like, from a programming perspective, you're on a lower level protocol. It's always kind of tricky to get it right and understand all the trade-offs you're making. If you get a REST API, it's a very, I mean, state transition, right? So it's quite quite straightforward.
What is it, but
to interact.
But is Kafka a real? I mean, yeah, it's a queue. Of course. But what did I read? I mean, I think I still have it in my reading list.
And the and it has schemas, for instance, built in. So Kafka, it's more. I would say maybe Kafka is more of a toolkit in terms of, okay, we have all these solutions around that, and then you build your thing the way you need to use it. And it looks like Kafka already makes some decisions, or it's more on the framework, like we are a little bit opinionated kind of thing.
Oh yeah, and Kafka is only binary data, and as you said, you need to have an external schema store.
Yeah. But also
okay.
Using
Zookeeper,
it's I don't see so much of a difference.
Yeah, okay. Maybe to be discussed in a later podcast.
I think I actually also was wearing the same t-shirt you're just wearing. Now we're going from tech
Which
talk
is...
back to the t-shirts. what else? It's going to be interesting. Like, we want to, like, in this world, we want to, in container orchestration world, it's now very cheap to try it out and just start, I would say. Could be something interesting.
Orchestration?
No, it's just, like, if you are having your own cloud and you have these nice isolations, then it's no harm done if you just try out something. It's just you don't have to put it into production, but you do a little learning around it and then understand trade-offs. I mean, that's totally possible.
Yeah, but that's what we're doing for years now, right? We had to create our own Docker files and Docker Compose files. And now with Kubernetes, since everyone is using Kubernetes, it's the recipes are out there easier.
Okay, I guess what I'm saying is production, it's similar production. It's like, of course, we can in our tiny clusters with our desktops and we have something, but it's nicer to have something more, like terabytes of data, not gigabytes of data.
Yeah, of course.
But
the more the merrier.
Now we can. Or the place where we can. that's. But, yeah, let's see. And then what else?
yeah, I mean, staying at Kubernetes a bit, I'm fiddling around with GPUs currently, and I fell in love with the GPU device plugin, or a device plugin in general for Kubernetes, which is pretty neat.
So you did one, or there is already one for GPUs?
Yeah, there is one, but I wrote my own, of course.
Because you can.
Because I can. Yeah, there is one from NVIDIA, but it relies on the NVIDIA Docker runtime underneath so that it works correctly. And I took all the primitives of the device plugin to make it work with plain Docker as well. I mean, not to the full function set that NVIDIA Docker provides, but at least a little starting point. Because it turns out that CUDA is pretty complicated to generalize. So.
No shit, Sherlock.
No, the thing is, I mean, it's all a lot of fuss about this GPU use case and people using it all over the place. And they use it a lot in data science, of course.
Yeah.
And not to offend data scientists, but not to offend data scientists, but they focus more on the analytics than on the programming and how it works underneath, I would say, right? It
should just work for them. I was late.
Yeah, they use Python and they...
Yeah, Here's this tool, let me do my thing with it. They are not interested in the thing doing something, then it's just not a thing.
Yeah, exactly. So how CUDA is tied into TensorFlow, they don't care. They just want to use TensorFlow.
Yes.
And the implementation details are just that, implementation details.
I actually don't know how you review, and it seems that you have taken a deep look into how like TensorFlow operations result in CUDA code.
Yeah, you know me, and deep looks are not my thing sometimes.
I was thinking that, okay, a tensor that is actually representable as a vector of floats. I think even TensorFlow makes an assumption that it's actually not using floats. I think it's all integers. Is that true?
I think it depends on...
Deep learning frameworks were not using float arithmetic.
No. The AI and deep learning frameworks, they don't need as much accuracy as we used to have. I mean, normally floating points and double precision floating points, so 64-bit floating points are the thing. And with deep learning, you don't care about it because you average about across so many values that it doesn't matter if you have like 500 digits or only 15. And there are a lot of studies, and I'm taking like out of my league here, but what I gathered is there are a lot of studies that show that even with 8 bits accuracy, you can get the same results as with 16 bits, for instance. But you only need half of the memory, of course, and it's much, much faster. So the iteration speed is so much faster that you can trade off some accuracy and just run more models and gain the accuracy with all the models you run.
Ah, true. That makes total sense, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you think about memory of graphics cards and also computational power of graphics cards, or accelerator cards for that matter, they are all going down now. So the previous decades, they all went up, right? They want to have higher and higher accuracy for the simulations they did. And with deep learning, they are going down now. So you have 8-bit integer and even 6-bits, I think, so they're getting down to have more oomph.
Actually, it's depending on how the device drive actually gives you abilities for a machine learning workload. You can use that arithmetic. What I'm saying is it's transparent for the GPU. Like the compute in the GPU is, you can run it with 32 precision or you can run it with 8 precision. It's not
yeah,
a hardware thing.
It's not a hardware thing, and the less precision you have, the more computational power, right? So 64 bits, maybe you have one petaflops, so one peta floating point operations per second. And if you cut it to 32, you have 2 petaflops. If you cut it to 16, you have 4, and so on.
Yeah.
And so you have a great advantage if you reduce the precision because you gain so much computational power.
That makes sense.
And computational power in where I come from, like HPC, they measure it in flops, right? Floating point operation seconds. And the floating points are 64-bit floating points. So to reach a certain level of floating point operations, you need this power. But if you say like AI needs only 8 bits, then you have a much higher computational power. Of course, I mean it's a bruch, right? It's a, what is it? The thing. Yeah. No, but it's cool. And it's all the rage, right? And a lot of people want to try and use deep learning frameworks or this Python AI frameworks as well. I mean, we should discuss a little bit about AI, or like explain AI, machine learning, and deep learning. AI is pretty old, like decades old.
The thing, my department rebranded AI to what's known as machine learning.
Yeah, but AI is a pretty old field, right? Machine learning is a little bit younger.
No, I mean,
and now we have deep learning, which is only a couple of years old.
I'm feeling the buzz, getting back. I can get angry now about the industry. Should I go off? I hate that.
What?
I hate that they did this to AI. AI is something, I mean, that's really AI. Like, the next step beyond human. What they
That's artificial intelligence.
Yeah, but that...
Yeah, it could be a buzzword if you...
That's a greater goal of just a car around houses.
Yeah, but I mean, it's so old, this...
It doesn't matter. That's just wrong, I tell you. And it's machine learning, and with that, it's just statistics. And neural nets are just a very stupid way of thinking anything, but throwing numbers around. I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
But I'm also not a fan.
You're not a fan.
By the way.
True, yeah, I remember. I forgot about that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you don't like the Linux kernel, of course. I mean, it's such a painful project. But I think you're biased.
It's utter bullshit designed by complete idiots. I think that was what Linus Torvald was saying. It's utter bullshit. Anyhow, good. These workloads, it's actually interesting. So how get the compute into orchestration and the problem space? I mean, everybody tries to apply deep learning to anything they can think of currently, because it's like searching the golden nugget. Can we solve a problem that nobody else has solved before, and now we have it, so we have a market advantage or something? And it's legit. I can totally see that.
And we have so much hay, so the pile of hay is so big, there must be a golden nugget in there somewhere. Let's just mine it.
But probably the internet really is just consisting and the data out of not so much useful stuff. Maybe that's also the truth. But after we've killed the planet by burning energy, we know better. Lately was... Somebody was saying, like, data, I mean, there's this phrase, data is the new oil. And then the guy was saying, actually, oil wasn't a good idea in the first place.
That's true. So maybe you should brand it as a new renewable energy or something. That makes a better phrase.
Positive.
Data is the new oil. Yeah.
So how would that look like in Kubernetes? You would have your kubelets, and you would, of course, then selectively label, say, your special hardware with, like, this is super duper NVIDIA hardware. And then I understand so much that you can basically, in your deployment descriptor, with the label selection, assign your workloads, your pods to that hardware in the Kubernetes cluster, and then it comes down to...
No. That's a simple way of thinking about it. I mean, you could apply a label to a GPU node and say, okay, give me a node with this label, which would put this workload onto a node with GPUs. But you don't know how many GPUs, you don't know which GPUs, so you don't know, actually you don't know much. I mean, you could create a label again that describes this, but if you have multiple GPUs in a node, what you really want to have is Kubernetes scheduling individual GPUs. So let's say you have four GPUs and you schedule a pod that needs two GPUs that it's scheduled on this node, and it takes two of those GPUs out of this node. And so another pod can also be scheduled using another GPU, so that three GPUs are used by those two pods and one is still available. And what the device plugins do is they register a gRPC socket with the kubelet saying, hey buddy, I know you are in charge of this node, and I tell you, you have GPUs, and this is how much. You have three GPUs, four GPUs.
Okay, is that
because, that's what I tell you.
Is that because... my iPad runs out of power because of, I guess, 110 volts on the... Shit. So the video might be gone soon.
Yeah, but it's... Yeah, since it's...
But it's an audio podcast.
Audio podcast. It's like, you saw my t-shirt already, so no worries.
All right, but I was under the impression. So GPU compute is not modeled as the normal C group thing, where you
No, we're talking about orchestration now. I'm talking about GPU or device plugins in Kubernetes in general, using GPU as an example of it. Maybe we finish the orchestration piece and then I can talk about the container level thingy.
Okay.
So the device plugin registers with the kubelet and tells the kubelet, here buddy, you have special powers, you have four GPUs. Then the kubelet will reach out to the Kubernetes management, the API server, and will tell the API server, listen, if someone wants GPUs, point in my direction, I can handle it. And if you specify a resource in your Kubernetes description in the object, and you say resource kniep.org/GPU=2, then the scheduler will find you a pod with and a node with two GPUs available. And when this pod is scheduled, the Kubernetes will, just before the container is started, will hand over the container description to the device plugin so that the device plugin can do its magic. So it can add devices, it can add mount points, it can add environment variables to the configuration, and then hands it back to the kubelet and starts the container. That's it.
To me, this sounds a little bit an inversion of how things currently are. When
the thing currently is.
Does it need to know about its hardware, underlying hardware? Does it do that? Like, say, in a very trivial, my Java application on a host, the kubelet does nothing else than talking to the API server and executing commands, proxy, like use the kubeproxy, and then talking to the controllers and managing the event handling and all of that. But it not necessarily knows about 32 cores or something.
Exactly, and this is, I mean, normally the Kubernetes is only executing what the scheduler elite decides the kubelet to schedule, right? So it will hand down an object and say, this is a container you should start, do it, you are my worker.
You described it as basically a little bit inverse to that.
No, not inverse. Just in addition, you get this configuration of the container that the kubelet should start. That's handed down to the kubelet. And the kubelet, since the resource GPU was scheduled or was requested, this configuration is passed to the device plugin, and the device plugin can add stuff to this configuration. For instance, add a GPU or add two GPUs. So that, and for, let's say, there are many other device plugins, right? So it could be anything. And the idea is, or the thing that it makes possible is, that it's in the hand of the node. There is a little bit of logic on the node as to what devices are mapped or what stuff is done, right? Because the scheduler might not have all the information, or it would be overloaded with all the information that it needs to make the decision that is needed in order to make the GPU useful for the container on the node. So say you have you have four GPUs, as said, so you will have a device that's called NVIDIA 0, NVIDIA 1, NVIDIA 2, and NVIDIA 3. And depending on how much cubes, how many pods are already running using GPUs, you either get the first, the second, the third, or the fourth. So, but the scheduler, I mean, he could track all of this, but that would overload his scheduling power.
Responsibilities are basically handled on the individual node level. It's being... Like, there needs to be a upwards communication, basically registering and making the API aware. So when the API server makes a scheduling decision, he can take into account that this is a request and that constrains the scheduling decision or makes it actually possible. So if you're trying to do the workload on a cluster which does not run with these drivers, your pod does not be scheduled. The API server will need to know that for this requirement here, and then therefore the pod gets not scheduled.
Yeah, it's not the API server, it's the scheduler schedules, right? But that's
if he makes the assignment, like when he tries to assign the pod to the kubelet, he has this function of values where to put something, and
but the thing is, the scheduler doesn't hold a state of all. I mean, he could, but it will. He will explode, right? Because if you have thousands of nodes, and he has needs to get keep track of all the resources already scheduled on the host, then it's like complicated, right? And this device plugin makes it possible to just say, I have four devices. Two devices are already scheduled, and the rest is at the node level decided. So yeah, he doesn't need to compile the complete configuration.
Needs to know that you come now and want to have like you're running two GPUs already, and you want to say scale that, and you scale it from 2 to 6, but you only have 4. Then the API server will figure, no, I'm not scheduling.
The scheduler will figure. Yeah. Because of course.
And that registration goes. That's just what I'm to recap my. If I understand you right, a kube worker will basically say, I have a device plugin, and then it does the upwards communication until the API server really is in the know that there is special hardware really, and then he can make his scheduling decision. The details, if a pod say, now I'm having my super special CUDA code at hand, all that device details, that's no knowledge for the API server up there, that's handled on the node to say, okay, cool, you want that many shares, and okay, I have that capacity. Then the device plugin is in charge of the interaction between the containerized application on that host to the device. I mean, it's a device thing in the end.
Yeah, but maybe to put it a little bit different, you have labels, which are just key value pairs, right? Strings. And the scheduler will find a node that matches whatever you described as your node selector, right? And this is just a string, right? It's just key value. So you could have a value, a key pair, a label that says, I have a GPU. So you could make sure that the node or the pod is scheduled on a node that has a GPU. But you do not know how many GPUs are already used and what other pods are using this because you are scheduling this just based on the node, on the labels. And with device plugins, you also have kind of labels, but the value of the label is an integer. And the integer can be increased and decreased. I mean, you say I have four GPUs, and the key is whatever. It can be bullshit or whatever. It's just a string. And you request the string, and you request a quantity for the string. And in the pod, you say, I want 2 GPUs, so this label is GPU, and the quantity of the label is 2, or the resource is 2, and then the scheduler will find a node that has the quantity left that you requested. And so you can make sure that you are not oversubscribing, and you don't have to jump to fire loops, to make sure that you are not oversubscribing the GPU resource. Because the scheduler knows, okay, he has 4, a pod with 2 is already scheduled, so I can schedule pods with 2 or 1 requests for GPUs. And when the pod is destroyed, then the number will go up again.
So you can actually, okay, I guess I'm not that familiar. So by using device plugin, it's basically paradigm for Kubernetes itself to say devices go into resources like on the what's that yeah if it's a if it's a replica set it's also a resource
thing Kubernetes object
and then the API server or the scheduler basically is okay I have this resource constraint here so I take it also into account I'm not using label only but also what's been defined here in the special resource section
yeah, exactly. That's how I would describe it. And in addition, this device plugin, as I said before, can change the configuration slightly of the container that started. So it can add devices. It actually can map in a NVIDIA or whatever GPU or device into the container, and it can change environment variables, and it can also bind mount something into the container.
Can it make your program high?
It's not in Florida. It's not in California.
But basically, you rip apart a little bit of a contract, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's true. The Agile scheduler does not really know all the specifics of the container configuration because the device plugin can override or add stuff.
But even worse, I as an application provider expect a certain CUDA version to be compiled in a certain way because I found this very nice loophole in this CUDA specification that just gave me a black hole in my super duper computation, and then I can travel back in time. And now I'm scheduled on a GPU where it says no, let's not do that. And then I don't know that.
Yeah, I think
would I get feedback?
That's where it gets messy because you could use a node label to specify which CUDA version, and then you will be scheduled at a node with GPU resource and the correct CUDA version. But that's okay. It's not a perfect solution, but it's this is where I struggle. I think that's also where I struggle with CUDA and make sure that you have the correct CUDA version with the correct driver and so on.
The same that NVIDIA did, right? They actually cloned the Docker daemon, right? And
they wrapped RunC with a little thin wrapper, and in the OCI runtime specification, so the configuration you hand over to the runtime, you can specify post start and pre start and post stop and pre stop hooks that are executed, respectively what I just said, right before the start or after the start of the container and so on. And what NVIDIA Docker does, it injects this hook as a pre-start hook and will execute, or it used to, I think that's still the case, or did they change it? I think no, that's how it works still. They execute a binary just before the container is started. All the namespaces are set, all the snapshots or the root file system of the container already there, and then they can detect what version of CUDA is available on the host. They can inspect the binary that is executed to be executed, and they can determine where the library should be placed, and they can make very smart decisions about it. And with my device plugin, I do not do the smart decisions. I just map in the device,
but to be fair,
and I map in the default.
Hobby, right? Yeah, you're doing that.
Yeah,
just to explore the field.
Yeah, and this CUDA thing, I think that's
now,
where the real meat is.
In beta, Kniep's device driver, and give me $1 million for it.
That's basically the pitch. Yeah. That's what I do here in Berlin. Like, go to the supermarket and I do this pitch, but no one gives me $1 million.
Hey, Granny, you need a device driver for India, Wesley. You need that.
What is a device? Yeah. But maybe someday someone will say, yeah, sure, here is $1 million. Let me think. I have some change.
I came to the conclusion that $1 million is just not enough, actually. I think
it's not
better.
Yeah, better. The more the merrier, I guess. Yeah, no. So this is a scheduling piece.
Okay.
And
I think that's quite interesting. You want to go into more detail?
So the scheduling piece is rather defined because you have this device plugin and you can do this and this. So the Kubernetes piece is, I think, rather easy to understand. And it's also easy to implement. I mean, if a company puts, let's say, I'm not saying a company, but if you put your mind to it, it's rather easy. It's like 50 lines of Go. It's easy. Where the real meat on the bone is, you need to have the application knowledge to make smart decisions and build smart containers so that you can run the CUDA workload with the correct, as you said, the correct version that matches the driver and so on. And so you cannot just give this device plugin to a customer who has no clue what he's doing, he will fail. If you give it to a customer that knows what he's doing, that he understands his CUDA requirements, or you have a limited use case like TensorFlow in Jupyter Notebooks, for instance, that's my prototype-ish experiment that I'm doing, And it's, I think, a very, very major use case for a lot of companies because
Jupyter Notebooks. It's like, okay, now we say you use a special version of TensorFlow, which can already make some decisions about which CUDA will be actually there. So you kind of, as a cloud provider, you would go, okay, I'm complying with TensorFlow spec, blah, blah, blah. Then therefore my hardware looks like blah, blah, blah. I run this device plugins and everything should be happy.
Yeah, it's in general, it's about expectation management. So you don't want the customer to expect that everything will just work. You want to make sure that the customer understands you want to run Jupyter Notebooks with TensorFlow 1.7. This is the container. This is the device plugin. This is how you prepare the node. And this will work. So we have a certified installation. We have a certified container. And they match.
Yeah, makes sense.
And that's
a little. So imagine AWS. What do they like? They are very generic, right? That's the whole point of these clouds. It's like you have these compute, and it's just there. And now you have these special thingies. So how would you imagine Amazon will actually do provide these? So they will come up with special. Of hardwares or certain racks will just be.
No, they already have devices for certain instances, but I think what they do is, and didn't they announce it with Nvidia? They just go up the stack and provide a higher level service which abstracts all this stuff out for the user, and the user can just use.
They need to solve it. Still, I came along with my very old TensorFlow. And AWS just upgraded all the data center to this NVIDIA stuff, and it just doesn't match. So the generic thing of the cloud is now limited for these because you kind of go for a special use case.
Yeah. I mean, this is people much more knowledgeable about Java and Python and CUDA. I think it's maybe more clear, and hopefully it's more compatible with older versions, so that if you have a newer version, like a newer driver version, older CUDA versions will just work. So you can update your driver and don't care about who is running on it, because that's like with the kernel that you hate. The better the kernel, the higher the kernel, the better normally if you do container stuff, because you have more features and optimized stuff in it. The higher the number, if it's compatible, backwards compatible.
Now, I was just lately in the situation where I had to, like, I went basically, elevated my application through several levels of quality assurance in Kubernetes clusters. And of course, I went to production load and things didn't work, but they were just not partially, like this Heisenberg, right? If something was partially working, but partially not, and it's like, very annoying. And then we tried basically, what's that?
It's like this Braveheart thing. But if we fire this direction, we will hit our own troops. But also the other one.
Yes.
And this is like paraphrased.
But that's military thinking.
but it works most of the time, but not like 5% of the time. It doesn't.
So what I was trying. So what's that remote debugger? I forgot the name just yet.
GDB?
Huh?
No.
The remote.
I'm just throwing out words.
So we have some. Is it version 9? No, it's not version.
CubeSpy?
No, it's the other one. Oh. Anyhow, you want to dig into your container workloads, but then you are in production. So this is something where security gets all outraged about. You're poking holes into servers and open ports, and that's all not good. But the phenomenon that makes your application break just needs to be in that context, apparently, to reproduce it. But you don't get these. So it's very hard for us to... Okay, we got Prometheus metrics, we have all the logging and centralized and everything, so we get some insights. But it actually was that difficult that we wanted to go step and step debug the load of code, because we were not comprehensive via metric logging. What's going on? And, I can imagine that have tensor workloads, that's even harder. Because like it's not an imperative program where you can by line by line by line, and it's all super clear. TensorFlow, it's kind of train that model, get me that net, this. In a way it is, but I guess what
yeah,
I
would
like to say is like the application developer has a good chance of being very disconnected from where the execution happens, and if there are problems, it becomes hard to understand them.
Yeah, of course, because it's a black box, right?
Yeah.
You train a kid until it's five or whatever, and everything that it experienced will influence the decisions that it makes when it influences after it was trained, right?
How you're still thinking AI is a real thing.
Yeah, deep learning is a real thing, of course.
With kids.
Yeah, yep. Deep learning, I think, is, of course, it's a real thing.
I'm telling you, it's just fucking statistics. There is
yeah, of course, it is. But it solves problems. So it's not something that will go away.
Yeah. And since we had invented the oil, we were making V8 engines with lots of horsepowers, and that was really great. And now we don't have polar bears anymore.
Yeah, a couple of them are still left.
Now that's good. That's good. That's awesome.
Yeah, I rented an S5 the other day.
An S5.
Cabrio. That was fun. Yeah.
APT or what?
But it's
upped.
No, 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 no. Normal.
Normal
S5.
Yeah.
That was fun. Crazy.
I was riding a Tesla yesterday.
Oh.
And no, and I was co-driving, so I was sitting aside, and I was not myself driving. That thing has punch. Like that's really
yeah,
exciting.
I can imagine. Yeah,
that's really, really exciting.
Yeah, and we are getting from very nerdy tech stuff to like, oh, cars.
Yeah, cars. Cars are amazing. The thing is, I want to make this short podcast this time even shorter because I'm not feeling very, very well. I met some Australian people yesterday, and that's
yeah. They are the worst.
Something. But I think exactly
drinking buddies.
The interesting. There are some really, really cool, interesting applications now. When you and Kubernetes, I really like Kubernetes for something, and it's really fun to work with. And yeah, having this custom hardware and knowing that we. Oh, but I cannot talk about that offline. Apparently, I cannot talk about it. But there's a very. It's exciting.
That's good.
I cannot talk
exciting
about
is always good.
Should we find
yeah, no.
Like saying the next goal is to not use Linux kernel anymore, not use Golang anymore, and only work with
No. Back off. I mean, the Linux kernel brought us containers, like brought us Kubernetes. So you cannot go away. And Golang brought us Docker, Golang brought us Kubernetes, so
Yeah.
You're shaking on the pillars of what you like, so you have to be careful.
Way, I like that on an idealistic way. I think we should go another round of data. I'm just rephrasing that every podcast now. So in 1,000 years, when they dig up the information from us too, they will see. Oh, Hagen was right all the way. Like 1,000 years ago, you were this brilliant guy. Why did that not happen?
Yeah, but it's a brilliancy just to despise everything that it's new and fresh and working and people adopt because it works. And you just want to go back to, let's use pen and paper. That's a cool thing. Let's use parentheses. They're all over the place. The more and more parentheses, that's the better.
Parentheses are...
You're an idealist. And then, but the real life needs answers now.
Yeah,
we cannot wait for the optimal idealistic
totally
solution.
I totally do that, understand that, and I'm working with it, and it gets me excited too, so I don't hate my life, but there's just like to have these vision.
Yeah, in hangover solutions, situations where you reflect what you're doing, you hate yourself. because you use Kubernetes, the Linux kernel, and you kind of like it. but you feel the cognitive dissonance that you should not like it.
Yeah, but I mean, yin yang, that's the whole Zen thing. Like, there are dark sides and bright sides, and all, that's all good.
All the sides.
All right.
Cool.
I have to call it a day, unfortunately. I'm sorry, listener.
I call it a day. I'm in Berlin. It's 9 p.m. for me, or 7 p.m. And for you, it's just morning.
Yeah, for me, it's 9 a.m., right? 9:50 a.m., yeah.
All right. When are you back?
No, let's hang up the podcast and continue
talking. Okay. Okay, guys. Hopefully, we will not. It will not take like half a year until we make the...
Hopefully not. I'm back in 3 weeks, so
okay.
We can meet in Berlin.
Hopefully.
Alright. Thanks for listening.
Okay, guys. Thanks for listening. For those who are still listening. Bye-bye.